what I'm talking about. Harding's face and hands are moving faster than ever now, a speeded film of gestures, grins, grimaces, sneers. The more he tries to stop it, the faster he goes. When he lets his hands and face move like they want to and doesn't try to hold them back, they flow and gesture in a way that's real pretty to watch. But when he worries them and tries to hold back, he becomes a wild, jerky puppet doing a high-strung dance. Everything is moving faster and faster, and his voice is speeding up to match. "Why, see here, my friend Mr. McMurphy, my psychopathic sidekick, our Miss Ratchet is a veritable angel of mercy, and why, just everyone knows it. She's unselfish as the wind, toiling thanklessly for the good of all, day after day, 5 long days a week. That takes heart, my friend, heart. In fact, I have been informed by sources. I am not at liberty to disclose my sources, but I might say that Martini is in contact with the same people a good part of the time. That she even further serves mankind on her weekends off by doing generous volunteer work about town. Preparing a rich array of charity, canned goods, cheese for the binding effect, soap, and presenting it to some poor young couple having a difficult time financially." His hands flash in the air, molding the picture he is describing. "Ah, look, there she is, our nurse. Her gentle knock at the door, the ribboned basket, the young couple overjoyed to the point of speechlessness, the husband open-mouthed, the wife weeping openly. She appraises their dwelling, promises to send them money for scouring powder, yes. She places the basket in the center of the floor. And when our angel leaves, throwing kisses, smiling ethereally, she is so intoxicated with the sweet milk of human kindness that her deed has generated within her large bosom that she is beside herself with generosity. Beside herself, do you hear? Pausing at the door, she draws the timid young bride to one side and offers her $20 of her own. Go, you poor, unfortunate, underfed child. Go and buy yourself a decent dress. I realize your husband can't afford it, but here, take this and go, and the couple is forever indebted to her benevolence." He's been talking faster and faster, the cord stretching out in his neck. When he stops talking, the ward is completely silent. I don't hear anything but a faint, reeling rhythm, what I figure is a tape recorder somewhere getting all of this. Harding looks around, sees everybody's watching him, and he does his best to laugh. A sound comes out of his mouth like a nail being crowbarred out of a plank of green pine. He can't stop it. He wrings his hands like a fly and clenches his eyes at the awful sound of that squeaking, but he can't stop. It gets higher and higher until finally, with a suck of breath, he lets his face fall into his waiting hands.
"Oh, the bitch, the bitch, the bitch,"
he whispers through his teeth. McMurphy lights another cigarette and offers it to him. Harding takes it without a word. McMurphy is still watching Harding's face in front of him there, with a kind of puzzled wonder, looking at it like it's the first human face he ever laid eyes on. He watches while Harding's twitching and jerking slows down, and the face comes up from the hands. "You are right," Harding says, "about all of it." He looks up at the other patients who are watching him. No one's ever dared come out and say it before, but there's not a man among us that doesn't think it, that doesn't feel just as you do about her and the whole business. Feel it somewhere down deep in his scared little soul. McMurphy frowns and asks,
"What about that little fart of a doctor? He might be a little slow in the head, but not so much as not to be able to see how she's taken over and what she's doing."
Harding takes a long pull off the cigarette and lets the smoke drift out with his talk. "Dr. Spivey is exactly like the rest of us, McMurphy. Completely conscious of his inadequacy. He's a frightened, desperate, ineffectual little rabbit. Totally incapable of running this ward without our Miss Ratchet's help, and he knows it. And worse, she knows he knows it and reminds him every chance she gets. Every time she finds he's made a little slip in the bookwork or in, say, the charting, you can just imagine her in there grinding his nose in it."
"That's right," Cheswick says,
coming up beside McMurphy.
Grinds our noses in our mistakes.
Why don't he fire her?
In this hospital, Harding says, the doctor doesn't hold the power of hiring and firing. That power goes to the supervisor, and the supervisor is a woman, a dear old friend of Miss Ratchett's. They were army nurses together in the 30s. We are victims of a matriarchy here, my friend, and the doctor is just as helpless against it as we are. He knows that all Ratchett has to do is pick up that phone you see sitting at her elbow and call the supervisor and mention, oh, say that the doctor seems to be making a great number of requisitions for Demerol.
Hold it, Harding. I'm not up on all his shop talk.
Demerol, my friend, is a synthetic opiate, twice as addictive as heroin. Quite common for doctors to be addicted to it.
That little fart! Is he a dope addict?
I'm certain I don't know.
Then where does she get off accusing him of...
Oh, you're not paying attention, my friend. She doesn't accuse. She merely needs to insinuate. Insinuate anything, don't you see? Didn't you notice today? She'll call a man to the door of the nurse's station and stand there and ask him about a Kleenex found under his bed. No more. Just ask. And he'll feel like he's lying to her, whatever answer he gives. If he says he was cleaning a pen with it, she'll say, I see, a pen. Or if he says he has a cold in his nose, she'll say, I see, a cold. And she'll nod her neat little gray coiffure and smile her neat little smile and turn and go back into the nurse's station, leave him standing there, wondering just what did he use that Kleenex for. He starts to tremble again, and his shoulders fold back around him. No, she doesn't need to accuse. She has a genius for insinuation. Did you ever hear her, in the course of our discussion today, ever once hear her accuse me of anything? Yet it seems I have been accused of a multitude of things, of jealousy and paranoia, of not being man enough to satisfy my wife, of having relations with male friends of mine, of holding my cigarette in an affected manner, even, it seems to me, accused of having nothing between my legs but a patch of hair, and soft and downy and blonde hair at that. Ball cutter. Oh, you underestimate her.
Harding hushes all of a sudden and leans forward to take McMurphy's hand in both of his. His face is tilted oddly, edged, jagged purple and gray, a busted wine bottle.
This world belongs to the strong, my friend. The ritual of our existence is based on the strong getting stronger by devouring the weak. We must face up to this.
No more than right that it should be this way.
We must learn to accept it as a law of the natural world. The rabbits accept their role in the ritual and recognize the wolf as the strong. In defense, the rabbit becomes sly and frightened and elusive, and he digs holes and hides when the wolf is about. And he endures. He goes on. He knows his place. He most certainly doesn't challenge the wolf to combat. Now, would that be wise? Would it?
He lets go McMurphy's hand and leans back and crosses his legs, takes another long pull off the cigarette. He pulls the cigarette from his thin crack of a smile, and the laugh starts up again. Like a nail coming out of a plank.
Mr. McMurphy, my friend, I'm not a chicken. I'm a rabbit. The doctor is a rabbit. Cheswick there is a rabbit. Billy Bibbit is a rabbit. All of us in here are rabbits of varying ages and degrees, hippity-hopping through our Walt Disney world.
Oh, don't misunderstand me. We're not in here because we are rabbits. We'd be rabbits wherever we were. We're all in here because we can't adjust to our rabbithood. We need a good, strong wolf like the nurse to teach us our place.
Man, you're talking like a fool. You mean to tell me that you're going to sit back and let some old blue-haired woman talk you into being a rabbit?
Not talk me into it, no. I was born a rabbit. Just look at me. I simply need the nurse to make me happy with my role.
You're no damn rabbit! See the ears, the wiggly nose, the cute little button tail?
You're talking like a crazy man? How astute.
Damn it, Harding, I didn't mean it like that. You ain't crazy that way.
I mean, hell, I've been surprised how sane you guys all are. As near as I can tell, you're not any crazier than the average asshole on the street.
Ah, yes, the asshole on the street.
But not, you know, crazy like the movies paint crazy people. You're just kind of hung up and kind of
rabbit-like, isn't that it?
Rabbits, hell, not a thing like rabbits, goddammit. Mr. Bibbit, hop around for Mr. McMurphy here. Mr. Cheswick, show him how furry you are.
Billy Bibbit and Cheswick change into hunched-over white rabbits right before my eyes. But they are too ashamed to do any of the things Harding told them to do.
Ah, they're bashful, McMurphy. Isn't that sweet?
Or perhaps the fellows are ill at ease because they didn't stick up for their friend. Perhaps they are feeling guilty for the way they once again let her victimize them into being her interrogators.
Cheer up, friends. You've no reason to feel ashamed. It's all as it should be. It's not the rabbit's place to stick up for his fellow. That would have been foolish. No, you were wise. Cowardly, but wise.
Look here, Harding, Cheswick says.
No, no, Cheswick, don't get irate at the truth.
Now, look here, there's been times when I've said the same things about old Lady Ratchet that McMurphy has been saying.
Yes, but you said them very quietly and took them all back later. You are a rabbit, too. Don't try to avoid the truth. That's why I hold no grudge against you for the questions you asked me during the meeting today. You are only playing your role. If you had been on the carpet, or you, Billy, or you, Fredrickson, I would have attacked you just as cruelly as you attacked me. We mustn't be ashamed of our behavior. It's the way we little animals were meant to behave.
McMurphy turns in his chair and looks the other acutes up and down. I ain't so sure about what they should be ashamed. Personally, I thought it was damn crummy the way they swung in on her side against you. For a minute there, I thought I was back in a red Chinese prison camp.
Now, by God, McMurphy, Cheswick says, you listen here.
McMurphy turns and listens, but Cheswick doesn't go on. Cheswick never goes on. He's one of these guys who'll make a big fuss like he's going to lead an attack, holler charge and stomp up and down a minute, then take a couple steps and quit. McMurphy looks at him where he's been caught off base again after such a tough-sounding start and says to him, a hell of a lot like a Chinese prison camp. Harding holds up his hands for peace.
Oh, no, no, that isn't right. You mustn't condemn us, my friend. No.
In fact, I see that sly fever come into Harding's eye again. I think he's going to start laughing, but instead he takes his cigarette out of his mouth and points it at McMurphy. In his hand, it looks like one of his thin white fingers smoking at the end.
You too, Mr. McMurphy, for all your cowboy bluster and your sideshow swagger, you too, under that crusty surface, are probably just as soft and fuzzy and rabbit-souled as we are.
Yeah, you bet, I'm a little cottontail. Just what is it makes me a rabbit, Harding? My psychopathic tendencies? Is it my fighting tendencies or my fucking tendencies? Must be the fucking, mustn't it? Oh, that wham-bam, thank you, ma'am. Yeah, that wham-bam, that's probably what makes me a rabbit.
Wait, I'm afraid you've raised a point that requires some deliberation. Rabbits are noted for that certain trait, aren't they? Notorious, in fact, for their wham-bam.
Yes. But, in any case, the point you bring up simply indicates that you are a healthy, functioning, and adequate rabbit, whereas most of us in here even lack the sexual ability to make the grade as adequate rabbits.
Failures we are. Feeble, stunted, weak little creatures in a weak little race. Rabbits, sans wham-bam.
a pathetic notion.
Wait a minute, you keep twisting what I say. No, you were right. You remember, it was you that drew our attention to the place where the nurse was concentrating her pecking.
That was true. There's not a man here that isn't afraid he's losing or has already lost his wham-bam.
We comical little creatures can't even achieve masculinity in the rabbit world. That's how weak and inadequate we are. Hee! We are the rabbits, one might say, of the rabbit world.
He leans forward again, and that strained, squeaking laugh of his that I've been expecting begins to rise from his mouth, his hands flipping around, his face twitching.
Harding, shut your damn mouth!
It's like a slap. Harding is hushed, chopped off cold with his mouth still open in a drawn grin, his hands dangling in a cloud of blue tobacco smoke. He freezes this way a second, then his eyes narrow into sly little holes, and he lets them slip over to McMurphy, speaks so soft that I have to push my broom up right next to his chair to hear what he says.
Friend, you may be a wolf.
God damn it, I'm no wolf and you're no rabbit. Whew, I never heard such...
You have a very wolfy roar. With a loud hissing of breath, McMurphy turns from Harding to the rest of the acutes standing around.
Here, all you guys, what the hell is the matter with you? You ain't as crazy as all this, thinking you're some animal.
No,
Cheswick says, and steps in beside McMurphy.
No, by God, not me. I'm not any rabbit.
That's the boy, Cheswick, and the rest of you. Let's just knock it off. Look at you, talking to yourself and running scared from some 50-year-old woman. What is there she can do to you anyway?
Yeah, what?
Cheswick says and glares around at the others.
She can't have you whipped. She can't burn you with hot iron. She can't tie you to the rack. They got laws about that sort of thing nowadays. This ain't the Middle Ages. There's not a thing in the world that she can...
Eustace, it's all what you can do to us in the meeting today.
I see Billy Bibbit has changed back from a rabbit. He leans toward McMurphy trying to go on, his mouth wet with spit and his face red. Then he turns and walks away.
It's no use. I should just kill myself.
McMurphy calls after him.
Today? What did I see in the meeting today? Hell's bells, all I saw was her asking a couple of questions, and nice easy questions at that. Questions ain't bone breakers. They ain't sticks and stones.
Billy turns back.
But the way she asks them.
You don't have to answer, do you?
If you don't answer, she smiles and makes a note in her little book, and then she, oh, hell.
Scanlon comes up beside Billy.
If you don't answer her questions, Mac, you admit it just by keeping quiet. It's the way those bastards in the government get you. You can't beat it. The only thing to do is blow the whole business off the face of the whole bleeding earth. Blow it all up.
Well, when she asks one of those questions, why don't you tell her to up and go to hell?
Yeah, Cheswick says, shaking his fist. Tell her to up and go to hell.
So then would Max, she'd just come right back with, why do you seem so upset by that particular question, Patient McMurphy?
So you tell her to go to hell again, tell them all to go to hell, they still haven't hurt you.
The acutes are crowding closer around him. Fredrickson answers this time.
Okay, you tell her that and you're listed as potential assaultive and shipped upstairs to the disturbed ward. I had it happen. 3 times. Those poor goofs up there don't even get off the ward to go to the Saturday afternoon movie. They don't even have a TV.
And, my friend, if you continue to demonstrate such hostile tendencies, such as telling people to go to hell, you get lined up to go to the shock shop. Perhaps even on to greater things, an operation, and...
Damn it, Harding, I told you I'm not up on this talk.
The shock shop, Mr. McMurphy, is jargon for the EST machine, the electroshock therapy. A device that might be said to do the work of the sleeping pill, the electric chair, and the torture rack. It's a clever little procedure, simple, quick, nearly painless. It happens so fast, but no one ever wants another one. Ever.
What's this thing do?
You are strapped to a table shaped ironically like a cross, with a crown of electric sparks in place of thorns. You are touched on each side of the head with wires. Zap. 5 cents worth of electricity through the brain, and you are jointly administered therapy and a punishment for your hostile go-to-hell behavior, on top of being put out of everyone's way for 6 hours to 3 days, depending on the individual. Even when you do regain consciousness, you are in a state of disorientation for days. You are unable to think coherently. You can't recall things. Enough of these treatments and a man could turn out like Mr. Ellis you see over there against the wall, a drooling, pants-sweating idiot at 35, or turn into a mindless organism that eats and eliminates and yells, fuck the wife, like Ruckley. Or look at Chief Broom, clutching to his namesake there beside you. Harding points his cigarette at me, too late for me to back off. I make like I don't notice, go on with my sweeping. I've heard that the chief years ago received more than 200 shock treatments when they were really the vogue. Imagine what this could do to a mind that was already slipping. Look at him, a giant janitor. There's your vanishing American, a 6'8" sweeping machine, scared of its own shadow. That, my friend, is what we can be threatened with. McMurphy looks at me a while, then turns back to Harding.
Man, I tell you, how come you stand for it?
What about this Democratic ward manure that the doctor was giving me? Why don't you take a vote? Harding smiles at him and takes another slow drag on a cigarette.
Vote what, my friend? Vote that the nurse may not ask any more questions in group meeting? Vote that she shall not look at us in a certain way? You tell me, Mr. McMurphy, what do we vote on?
Hell, I don't care. Vote on anything. Don't you see that you have to do something to show that you still got some guts? Don't you see that you can't let her take over completely? Look at you here. You say the chief is scared of his own shadow, but I never saw a scareder-looking bunch in my life than you guys.
Not me, Cheswick says.
Maybe not you, buddy, but the rest are even scared to open up and laugh. You know, that's the first thing that got me about this place, that there wasn't anybody laughing. I haven't heard a real laugh since I came through that door. You know that? Man, when you lose your laugh, you lose your footing. A man go around letting a woman whoop him down till he can't laugh anymore, and he loses one of the biggest edges he's got on his side. First thing you know, he'll begin to think she's tougher than he is, and,
ah, I believe my friend is catching on, fellow rabbits. Tell me, Mr. McMurphy, how does one go about showing a woman who's boss? I mean, other than laughing at her. How does he show her who's king of the mountain?
A man like you should be able to tell us that. You don't slap her around, do you?
No, then she calls the law.
You don't lose your temper and shout at her. She'll win by trying to placate her big ol' angry boy. Is us widow man getting fussy, huh? Have you ever tried to keep up a noble and angry front in the face of such consolation? So you see, my friend, it is somewhat as you stated. Man has but one truly effective weapon against the juggernaut of modern matriarchy, but it certainly is not laughter. One weapon, and with every passing year in this hip, motivationally researched society, more and more people are discovering how to render that weapon useless and conquer those who have hitherto been the conquerors.
Lord Harding, but you do come on, McMurphy says.
And do you think for all your acclaimed psychopathic powers that you could effectively use your weapon against our champion? Do you think you could use it against Miss Ratchet, McMurphy? Ever?
And sweeps one of his hands toward the glass case. Everybody's head turns to look. She's in there, looking out through her window. Got a tape recorder hid out of sight somewhere, getting all this down, already planning how to work it into the schedule. The nurse sees everybody looking at her, and she nods, and they all turn away. McMurphy takes off his cap and runs his hands into that red hair. Now everybody is looking at him. They're waiting for him to make an answer, and he knows it. He feels he's been trapped some way. He puts the cap back on and rubs the stitch marks on his nose.
Why, if you mean, do I think I could get a bone up over that old buzzard? No, I don't believe I could.
She's not all that homely, McMurphy. Her face is quite handsome and well-preserved. And in spite of all her attempts to conceal them, in that sexless get-up, you can still make out the evidence of some rather extraordinary breasts. She must have been a rather beautiful young woman.
Still, for the sake of argument, could you get it up over her even if she wasn't old? Even if she was young and had the beauty of Helen?
I don't know Helen, but I see what you're driving at, and you're by God right. I couldn't get it up over old Frozen Face in there even if she had the beauty of Marilyn Monroe.
There you are. She's won.
That's it. Harding leans back, and everybody waits for what McMurphy's going to say next. McMurphy can see he's backed up against the wall. He looks at the faces a minute, then shrugs and stands up from his chair.
Well, what the hell? It's no skin off my nose.
That's true. It's no skin off your nose.
And I damn well don't want to have some old fiend of a nurse after me with 3,000 volts, not when there's nothing in it for me but the adventure.
No, you're right.
Harding's won the argument, but nobody looks too happy.
McMurphy hooks his thumbs in his pockets and tries a laugh.
No, sir. I never heard of anybody offering a 20-bone bounty for bagging a ball cutter.
Everybody grins at this with him, but they're not happy. I'm glad McMurphy is going to be cagey after all and not get sucked in on something he can't whip, but I know how the guys feel. I'm not so happy myself. McMurphy lights another cigarette. Nobody's moved yet. They're all still standing there, grinning and uncomfortable. McMurphy rubs his nose again and looks away from the bunch of faces hung out there around him, looks back at the nurse and chews his lip.
But you say she don't send you up to that other ward unless she gets your goat? Unless she makes you crack in some way and you end up cussing her out or busting a window or something like that?
Unless you do something like that.
You're sure of that now? Because I'm getting just the shadiest notion of how to pick up a good purse off you birds in here. But I don't want to be a sucker about it. I had a hell of a time getting out of that other hole. I don't want to be jumping out of the frying pan and into the fire.
Absolutely certain. She's powerless unless you do something to honestly deserve the disturbed ward or EST. If you're tough enough to keep her from getting to you, she can't do a thing.
So if I behave myself and don't cuss her out, or cuss one of the aides out, or cuss one of the aides out, or tear up Jack some way around here, she can't do nothing to me?
Those are the rules we play by. Of course she always wins, my friend. Always. She's impregnable herself, and with the element of time working for her, she eventually gets inside everyone. That's why the hospital regards her as its top nurse and grants her so much authority. She's a master at forcing the trembling libido out into the open.
The hell with that. What I want to know is, am I safe to try to beat her at her own game? If I come on nice as pie to her, whatever else I insinuate, she ain't gonna get in a tizzy and have me electrocuted?
You're safe as long as you keep control. As long as you don't lose your temper and give her actual reason to request the restriction of the disturbed ward or the therapeutic benefits of electroshock, you're safe. But that entails first and foremost keeping one's temper. And you, with your red hair and black record, why delude yourself?
Okay, all right. McMurphy rubs his palms together. Here's what I'm thinking. You birds seem to think you got quite the champ in there, don't you?
Quite the, what did you call her?
Sure, impregnable woman. What I want to know is, how many of you are dead sure enough to put a little money on her?
Dead sure enough?
Just what I said. Any of you sharpies here willing to take my $5 that says I can get the best of that woman before the week's up without her getting the best of me? 1 week. And if I don't have her to where she don't know whether to shit or go blind, the bet is yours.
You're betting on this?
Cheswick is hopping from foot to foot and rubbing his hands together like McMurphy rubs his.
You're damn right.
Harding and some of the others say that they don't get it.
It's simple enough. There ain't nothing noble or complicated about it. I like to gamble, and I like to win, and I think I can win this gamble, okay? It got so at Pendleton the guys wouldn't even lag pennies with me on account of I was such a winner. Why, one of the big reasons I got myself sent here was because I needed some new suckers.
I'll tell you something. I found out a few things about this place before I came here.
Damn near half you guys in here pull compensation. $300-$400 a month, and not a thing in the world to do with it but let it draw dust. I thought I might take advantage of this and maybe make both our lives a little more richer. I'm starting level with you. I'm a gambler, and I'm not in the habit of losing. And I've never seen a woman I thought was more man than me. I don't care whether I can get it up for her or not. She may have the element of time, but I got a pretty long winning streak going myself.
He pulls off his cap, spins it on his finger, and catches it behind his back in his other hand, neat as you please.
Another thing. I'm in this place because that's the way I planned it, pure and simple, because it's a better place than a work farm. As near as I can tell, I'm no loony or never knew it if I was.
Your nurse don't know this. She's not going to be looking out for somebody coming at her with a trigger-quick mind like I obviously got. These things give me an edge I like. So I'm saying $5 to each of you that wants it if I can't put a Betsy bug up that nurse's butt within a week.
I'm still not sure I...
Just that? A bee in her butt. A burr in her bloomers. Get her goat. Bug her till she comes apart of those neat little seams and shows just one time she ain't so unbeatable as you think. 1 week. I'll let you be the judge whether I win or not.
Harding takes out a pencil and writes something on the pinochle pad.
Here, a lien on $10 of that money they've got drawing dust under my name over in funds.
It's worth twice that to me, my friend, to see this unlikely miracle brought off.
McMurphy looks at the paper and folds it.
Worth it to any of the rest of you birds?
Other acutes line up now, taking turns at the pad. He takes the pieces of paper when they're finished, stacking them on his palm, pinned under a big stiff thumb. I see the pieces of paper crowd up in his hand. He looks them over.
You trust me to hold the bets, buddies?
I believe we can be safe in doing that, Harding says. You won't be going anyplace for a while. One Christmas, at midnight on the button, at the old place, the ward door blows open with a crash. In comes a fat man with a beard, eyes ringed red by the cold, and his nose just the color of a cherry. The black boys get him cornered in the hall with flashlights. I see he's all tangled in the tinsel public relation has been stringing all over the place, and he's stumbling around in it in the dark. He's shading his red eyes from the flashlights and sucking on his mustache.
Oh, 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 he says. I like to say, but I must be hurrying along. Very tight schedule, you know. Must be going.
The black boys move in with the flashlights. They kept him with us 6 years before they discharged him, clean-shaven and skinny as a pole. The big nurse is able to set the wall clock at whatever speed she wants just by turning one of those dials in the steel door. She takes a notion to hurry things up. She turns the speed up, and those hands whip around that disc like spokes in a wheel. The scene in that picture screen windows goes through rapid changes of light to show morning, noon, and night, throb off and on furiously with day and dark, and everybody's driven like mad to keep up with that passing of fake time. Awful scramble of shaves, and breakfasts, and appointments, and lunches, and medications, and 10 minutes of night so you barely get your eyes closed before the dorm's lights screaming at you to get up and start the scramble again. Go like a son of a bitch this way. Go through the full schedule of a day maybe 20 times an hour till the big nurse sees everybody is right up to the breaking point and she slacks off the throttle. Eases off the pace on that clock dial, like some kid been fooling with a moving picture projection machine, and finally got tired watching the film run at 10 times its natural speed. Got bored with all that silly scampering and insect squeak of talk and turned it back to normal. She's given to turning up the speed this way on days like, say, when you got somebody to visit you, or when the VFW brings down a smoker show from Portland. Times like that, times you'd like to hold and have stretch out, that's when she speeds things up. But generally it's the other way, the slow way. She'll turn that dial to a dead stop and freeze the sun there on the screen so it don't move a scant hair for weeks. So not a leaf on a tree or a blade of grass in the pasture shimmers. The clock hands hang at 2 minutes to 3, and she's liable to let them hang there till we rust. You sit solid and you can't budge. You can't walk or move to relieve the strain of sitting. You can't swallow and you can't breathe. The only thing you can move is your eyes. And there's nothing to see but petrified acutes across the room waiting on one another to decide whose play it is. The old chronic next to me has been dead 6 days, and he's rotting to the chair. And instead of fog sometimes, she'll let a clear chemical gas in through the vents, and the whole ward is set solid when the gas changes into plastic. Lord knows how long we hang this way. Then gradually, she'll ease the dial up a degree, and that's worse yet. I can take hanging dead still better than I can take that syrup slow hand of Scanlan across the room, taking 3 days to lay down a card. My lungs pull for the thick plastic air like getting it through a pinhole. I try to go to the latrine, and I feel buried under a ton of sand, squeezing my bladder till green sparks flash and buzz across my forehead. I strain with every muscle and bone to get out of that chair and go to the latrine. Work to get up till my arms and legs are all a shake and my teeth hurt. I pull and pull and all I gain is maybe a quarter inch off the leather seat. So I fall back and give up and let the pee pour out, activating a hot salt wire down my left leg that sets off humiliating alarms, sirens, spotlights, everybody up yelling and running around, and the black boys knocking the crowd aside left and right as the both of them rush headlong at me, waving awful mops of wet copper wires, cracking and spitting as they short with the water. About the only time we get any let-up from this time control is in the fog. Then time doesn't mean anything. It's lost in the fog, like everything else.
They haven't really fogged the place full force all day today, not since McMurphy came in. I bet he'd yell like a bull if they fogged it. When nothing else is going on, you usually got the fog or the time control to contend with, but today something's happened. There hasn't been any of these things worked on us all day, not since shaving. This afternoon, everything is matching up. When the swing shift comes on duty, the clock says 4:30, just like it should. The big nurse dismisses the black boys and takes a last look around the ward. She slides a long silver hatpin out of the iron-blue knot of hair back of her head, takes off her white cap, and sets it careful in a cardboard box. There's mothballs in that box, and she drives the hatpin back in the hair with a stab of her hand. Behind the glass, I see her tell everyone good evening. She hands the little birthmarked swing shift nurse a note. Then her hand reaches out to the control panel in the steel door, clacks on the speaker in the day room. "Good evening, boys. Behave yourselves." And turns the music up louder than ever. She rubs the inside of her wrist across her window. A disgusted look shows the fat black boy who just reported on duty that he better get to cleaning it, and he's at the glass with a paper towel before she so much as locked the ward door behind her. The machinery in the walls whistles, sighs, drops into a lower gear. Then, till night, we eat and shower and go back to sit in the day room. Old Blastic, the oldest vegetable, is holding his stomach and moaning. George, the black boys call him Rub-a-Dub, is washing his hands in the drinking fountain. The acutes sit and play cards and work at getting a picture on our TV set by carrying the set every place the cord will reach, in search of a good beam. The speakers in the ceiling are still making music. The music from the speakers isn't transmitted in on a radio beam is why the machinery don't interfere. The music comes off a long tape from the nurse's station, a tape we all know so well by heart that there don't any of us consciously hear it except new men like McMurphy. He hasn't got used to it yet. He's dealing blackjack for cigarettes, and the speaker's right over the card table. He's pulled his cap way forward till he has to lean his head back and squint from under the brim to see his cards. He holds a cigarette between his teeth and talks around it like a stock auctioneer I saw once in a cattle auction in the Dalles.
Hey, come on, come on, he says high, fast. I'm waiting on you suckers. You hit or you sit? Hit, you say? Well, 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 and with a king up, the boy wants a hit. What do you know? So coming at you, and too bad, a little lady for the lad, he's over the wall and down the road, up the hill and dropped his load. Coming at you, Scanlon, and I wish some idiot in that nurse's hothouse would turn down that friggin' music. Hoo-wee, does that thing play night and day, Harding? Never heard such a driving racket in all my life.
Harding gives him a blank look. Exactly what noise is it you're referring to, Mr. McMurphy?
That damn radio, boy! It's been going ever since I come in this morning, and don't come on with some baloney that you don't hear it.
Harding cocks his ear to the ceiling.
Oh, yes, the so-called music. Yes, I suppose we do hear it if we concentrate, but then one can hear one's own heartbeat, too, if he concentrates hard enough.
He grins at McMurphy.
You see, that's a recording playing up there, my friend. We seldom hear the radio. The world news might not be therapeutic. And we've all heard that recording so many times now, it simply slides out of our hearing, the way the sound of a waterfall soon becomes an unheard sound to those who live near it. Do you think if you live near a waterfall you could hear it very long?
I still hear the sound of the falls on the Columbia. Always will. Always. Hear the whoop of Charlie Bearbelly stabbed himself a big Chinook. Hear the slap of fish in the water. Laughing naked kids on the bank. The woman at the racks. From a long time ago.
Do they leave it on all the time like a waterfall?
McMurphy says.
Not when we sleep, Cheswick says. But all the rest of the time, and that's the truth. The hell with that. I'll tell that coon over there to turn it off or get his fat little ass kicked.
He starts to stand up, and Harding touches his arm. Friend, that is exactly the kind of statement that gets one branded assaultive. Are you so eager to forfeit the bet? McMurphy looks at him.
That's the way it is, huh? A pressure game? Keep the old pinch on?
That's the way it is. He slowly lowers himself back into his seat, saying,
Horse manure.
Harding looks about at the other acutes around the card table.
Gentlemen, already I seem to detect in our red-headed challenger a most unheroic decline of his TV cowboy stoicism.
He looks at McMurphy across the table, smiling. McMurphy nods at him and tips his head back for the wink and licks his big thumb.
Well, sir, old Professor Harding sounds like he's getting cocky. He wins a couple of splits and he goes to coming on like a wise guy. Well, well, well. There he sits with a deuce showing. And here's a pack of Marlboros as he backs down. Whoops, he sees me. Okie doke, Professor, here's a tray. He wants another. Gets another deuce. Try for the big five, Professor. Try for that big double pay or play it safe. Another pack says you won't. Well, 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 the professor sees me. This tells the tale. Too bad. Another lady and the professor flunks his exams.
The next song starts up from the speaker, loud and clangy and a lot of accordion. McMurphy takes a look up at the speaker and his spiel gets louder and louder to match it.
Hey, okay, next. God damn it, you hit or you sit. Coming at you.
Right up to the lights out at 9:30. I could have watched McMurphy at that blackjack table all night, the way he dealt and talked and roped them in and led them smack up to the point where they were just about to quit, then back down a hand or two to give them confidence and bring them along again. Once he took a break for a cigarette and tilted back in his chair, his hands folded behind his head, and told the guys, "The secret to being a top-notch con man is being able to know what the mark wants and how to make him think he's getting it. I learned that when I worked the season on a skillo wheel in a carnival. You feel the sucker over with your eyes when he comes up and you say, now here's a bird that needs to feel tough. So every time he snaps at you for taking him, you quake in your boots, scared to death, and tell him, please, sir, no trouble. The next roll is on the house, sir, so the both of you are getting what you want. He rocks forward and the legs of his chair come down with a crack. He picks up the deck, zips his thumb over it, knocks the edge of it against the table, licks his thumb and finger. And what I deduce you marks need is a big, fat pot to temptate you. Here's 10 packages on the next deal. Hey-ya! Coming at ya! Guts ball from here on out!
And throws back his head and laughs out loud at the way the guys hustle to get their bets down. That laugh banged around the day room all evening, and all the time he was dealing, he was joking and talking and trying to get the players to laugh along with him. But they were all afraid to loosen up. It had been too long. He gave up trying and settled down to serious dealing. They won the deal off him a time or two, but he always bought it back or fought it back, and the cigarettes on each side of him grew in bigger and bigger pyramid stacks. Then, just before 9:30, he started letting them win. Lets them win it all back so fast they don't hardly remember losing. He pays out the last couple of cigarettes and lays down the deck, and leans back with a sigh, and shoves the cap out of his eyes, and the game is done.
Well, sir, win a few, lose the rest, is what I say.
He shakes his head so forlorn.
I don't know. I was always a pretty shrewd customer at 21, but you birds may just be too tough for me. You got some kind of uncanny knack. Makes a man leery of playing against such sharpies for real money tomorrow.
He isn't even kidding himself into thinking they fall for that. He let them win, and every one of us watching the game knows it. So do the players. But there still isn't a man raking his pile of cigarettes. Cigarettes he didn't really win, but only won back because they were his in the first place. That doesn't have a smirk on his face like he's the toughest gambler on the whole Mississippi.
The fat black boy and a black boy named Giver run us out of the day room and commence turning lights off with a little key on a chain, and as the ward gets dimmer and darker, the eyes of the little birthmarked nurse in the station get bigger and brighter. She's at the door of the glass station, issuing nighttime pills to the men that shuffle past her in a line, and she's having a hard time keeping straight who gets poisoned with what tonight. She's not even watching where she pours the water. What has distracted her attention this way is that big red-headed man with the dreadful cap and the horrible-looking scar coming her way. She's watching McMurphy walk away from the card table in the dark day room, his one horny hand twisting the red tuft of hair that sticks out of the little cup at the throat of his work farm shirt. And I figure by the way she rears back when he reaches the door of the station that she's probably been warned about him beforehand by the big nurse. Oh, one more thing before I leave it in your hands tonight, Miss Pillbo. That new man sitting over there,
The one with the garish red sideburns and facial lacerations? I've reason to believe he is a sex maniac. McMurphy sees she's looking so scared and big-eyed at him. So he sticks his head in the station door where she's issuing pills and gives her a big friendly grin to get acquainted on. This flusters her so she drops the water pitcher on her foot. She gives a cry and hops on one foot, jerks her hand, and the pill she was about to give me leaps out of the little cup and right down the neck of her uniform where the birthmark stain runs like a river of wine down into a valley. Let me give you a hand, man. And that very hand comes through the station door scarred and tattooed in the color of raw meat.
Stay back, there are two aides on the ward with me.
She rolls her eyes for the black boys, but they are off tying chronics in bed, nowhere close enough to help in a hurry. McMurphy grins and turns the hand over so she can see he isn't holding a knife. All she can see is the light shining off the slick, waxy, calloused palm.
All I mean to do, miss, is to— Stay back! Patients aren't allowed to enter the— Oh, stay back! I'm a Catholic!
And straightaway jerks at the gold chain around her neck so a cross flies out from between her bosoms, slingshots the lost pill up in the air. McMurphy strikes at the air right in front of her face. She screams and pops the cross in her mouth and clenches her eyes shut like she's about to get socked. Stands like that, paper white, except for that stain which turns darker than ever, as though it sucked the blood from all the rest of her body. When she finally opens her eyes again, there's that callous hand right in front of her with my little red capsule sitting in it.
Was to pick up your watering can you dropped.
He holds that out in the other hand. Her breath comes out in a loud hiss. She takes the can from him.
Thank you. Good night. Good night.
And closes the door in the next man's face. No more pills tonight. In the dorm, McMurphy tosses the pill on my bed.
You want your sour ball, chief?
I shake my head at the pill, and he flips it off the bed like it was a bug pestering him. It hops across the floor with a cricket scrabble. He goes to get ready for bed, pulling off his clothes. The shorts under his work pants are coal black satin, covered with big white whales with red eyes. He grins when he sees I'm looking at the shorts.
From a co-ed at Oregon State, chief, a literary major.
He snaps the elastic with his thumb.
She gave them to me because she said I was a symbol.
His arms and neck and face are sunburned and bristled with curly orange hairs. He's got tattoos on each big shoulder. One says Fighting Leathernecks and has a devil with a red eye and red horns and an M1 rifle. And the other is a poker hand fanned out across his muscles, aces and eights. He puts his roll of clothes on the nightstand next to my bed and goes to punching at his pillow. He's been assigned the bed right next to mine. He gets between the sheets and tells me I better hit the sack myself, that here comes one of those black boys to douse the lights on us. I look around, and the black boy named Giver is coming, and I kick off my shoes and get in bed just as he walks up to tie a sheet across me. When he's finished with me, he takes a last look around and giggles and flips the dorm lights off. Except for the white powder of light from the nurse's station out in the hall, the dorm is dark. I can just make out McMurphy next to me, breathing deep and regular, the covers over him rising and falling. The breathing gets slower and slower till I figure he's been asleep for a while. Then I hear a soft, throaty sound from his bed, like the chuckle of a horse. He's still awake, and he's laughing to himself about something. He stops laughing and whispers,
Why, you sure did give a jump when I told you that coon was coming, chief. I thought somebody told me you was deaf.
First time for a long, long time I'm in bed without taking that little red capsule. If I hide to keep from taking it, the night nurse with the birthmark sends the black boy Giver out to hunt me down, hold me captive with his flashlight till she can get the needle ready. So I fake sleep when the black boy's coming past with his light. When you take one of those red pills, you don't just go to sleep. You're paralyzed with sleep. And all night long, you can't wake, no matter what goes on around you. That's why the staff gives me the pills. At the old place, I took to waking up at night and catching them performing all kinds of horrible crimes on the patients sleeping around me. I lie still and slow my breathing, waiting to see if something's going to happen. It is dark, my lord, and I hear them slipping around out there in their rubber shoes. Twice they peek in the dorm and run a flashlight over everybody. I keep my eyes shut and keep awake. I hear a wailing from up on Disturbed.
Lou, Lou, Lou.
Got some guy wired to pick up code signals.
Oh, a beer, I think, for the long night ahead.
I hear a black boy whisper to the other. Rubber shoes squeak off toward the nurse's station, where the refrigerator is.
You like a beer, sweet thing, with a birthmark, for the long night ahead?
The guy upstairs hushes. The low whine of the devices in the walls gets quieter and quieter, till it hums down to nothing. Not a sound across the hospital, except for a dull, padded rumbling somewhere deep in the guts of the building. A sound that I never noticed before. A lot like the sound you hear when you're standing late at night on top of a big hydroelectric dam. Low, relentless, brute power. The fat black boy stands out there in the hall where I can see him, looking all around and giggling. He walks toward the dorm door, slow, wiping the wet gray palms in his armpits. The light from the nurse's station throws his shadow on the dorm wall, big as an elephant. Gets smaller as he walks to the dorm door and looks in. He giggles again and unlocks the fuse box by the door and reaches in.
That's right, baby. Sleep tight.
Twists the knob and the whole floor goes to slipping down away from him standing in the door, lowering into the building like a platform in a grain elevator. Not a thing but the dorm floor moves, and we're sliding away from the walls and door and the windows of the ward at a hell of a clip, beds, bedstands, and all. The machinery, probably a cog and track affair at each corner of the shaft, is greased silent as death. The only sound I hear is the guy's breathing, and that drumming under us getting louder the farther down we go. The light of the dorm door 500 yards back up this hole is nothing but a speck, dusting the square sides of the shaft with a dim powder. It gets dimmer and dimmer till a faraway scream comes echoing down the sides of the shaft.
Stay back!
And the light goes out altogether. The floor reaches some kind of solid bottom far down in the ground and stops with a soft jar. It's dead black, and I can feel the sheet around me choking off my wind. Just as I get the sheet untied, the floor starts sliding forward with a little jolt. Some kind of casters under it I can't hear. I can't even hear the guys around me breathing, and I realize all of a sudden it's because that drumming's gradually got so loud I can't hear anything else. We must be square in the middle of it. I go to clawing at that damn sheet tied across me and just about have it loose when a whole wall slides up, reveals a huge room of endless machines stretching clear out of sight, swarming with sweating, shirtless men running up and down catwalks, faces blank and dreamy in firelight thrown from 100 blast furnaces. Everything I see looks like it sounded, like the inside of a tremendous dam. Huge brass tubes disappear upward in the dark. Wires run to transformers out of sight. Grease and cinders catch on everything, staining the couplings and motors and dynamos red and coal black. The workers all move at the same smooth sprint, an easy, fluid stride. No one's in a hurry. One will hold up a second, spin a dial, push a button, throw a switch. And one side of his face flashes white like lightning from the spark of the connecting switch, and run on, up steel steps and along a corrugated iron catwalk, past each other so smooth and close I hear the slap of wet sides like the slap of a salmon's tail on water. Stop again, throw lightning from another switch, and run on again. They twinkle in all directions, clean on out of sight, these flash pictures of the dreamy doll faces of the workmen. A workman's eyes snap shut while he's going at full run, and he drops in his tracks. Two of his buddies running by grab him up and lateral him into a furnace as they pass. The furnace whoops a ball of fire, and I hear the popping of a million tubes like walking through a field of seed pods. This sound mixes with the whir and clang of the rest of the machines. There's a rhythm to it, like a thundering pulse. The dorm floor slides on out of the shaft and into the machine room. Right away I see what's straight above us, one of those trestle affairs like you find in meat houses, rollers on tracks to move carcasses from the cooler to the butcher without much lifting. Two guys in slacks, white shirts with the sleeves turned back, and thin black ties are leaning on the catwalk above our beds, gesturing to each other as they talk. Cigarettes and long holders tracing lines of red light. They're talking, but you can't make out the words above the measured roar rising all around them. One of the guys snaps his fingers, and the nearest workman veers in a sharp turn and sprints to his side. The guy points down at one of the beds with his cigarette holder, and the worker trots off to the steel stepladder and runs down to our level, where he goes out of sight between two transformers, huge as potato cellars. When that worker appears again, he's pulling a hook along the trestle overhead and taking giant strides as he swings along it. He passes my bed, and a furnace whooping somewhere suddenly lights his face up right over mine, a face handsome and brutal and waxy like a mask, wanting nothing. I've seen a million faces like it. He goes to the bed, and with one hand grabs the old vegetable Blastic by the heel and lifts him straight up like Blastic don't weigh more than a few pounds. And the old guy's hanging there upside down, his moldy face blown up big, scared, the eyes scummed with mute fear. He keeps flapping both arms and the free leg till his pajama top falls around his head. The worker grabs the top and bunches and twists it like a burlap sack and pulls the trolley clicking back over the trestle to the catwalk and looks up to where those two guys in white shirts are standing. One of the guys takes a scalpel from a holster at his belt. There's a chain welded to the scalpel. The guy lowers it to the worker, loops the other end of the chain around the railing so the worker can't run off with a weapon. The worker takes the scalpel and slices up the front of old Blastic with a clean swing, and the old man stops thrashing around. I expect to be sick, but there's no blood or innards falling out like I was looking to see. Just a shower of rust and ashes, and now and again a piece of wire or glass. Worker's standing there to his knees in what looks like clinkers. A furnace got its mouth open somewhere. Licks up somebody. I think about jumping up and running around and waking up McMurphy and Harding as many of the guys as I can, but there wouldn't be any sense in it. If I shook somebody awake, he'd say, "Why, you crazy idiot, what the hell's eating you?" And then probably help one of the workers lift me onto one of those hooks himself, saying, "How about let's see what the insides of an Indian are like?" I hear the high, cold, whistling, wet breath of the fog machine. See the first wisps of it come seeping out from under McMurphy's bed. I hope he knows enough to hide in the fog. I hear a silly prattle, reminds me of somebody familiar, and I roll enough to get a look down the other way. It's the hairless public relation with the bloated face that the other patients are always arguing about why it's bloated. "I'll say he does," they'll argue. "Me, I'll say he doesn't. You ever hear of a guy really who wore one?" "Yeah, but you ever hear of a guy like him before?" The first patient shrugs and nods. Interesting point. Now he's stripped, except for a long undershirt with fancy monograms, sewed red on front and back. And I see once and for all, the undershirt rides up his back some as he comes walking past, giving me a peek, that he definitely does wear one, laced so tight it might blow up any second. And dangling from the stays, he's got half a dozen withered objects, tied by the hair like scalps. He's carrying a little flask of something that he sips from to keep his throat open for talking, and a camphor hanky he puts in front of his nose from time to time to stop out the stink. There's a clutch of school teachers and college girls and the like hurrying after him. They wear blue aprons and their hair in pin curls. They are listening to him give a brief lecture on the tour. He thinks of something funny and has to stop his lecture long enough for a swig from the flask to stop the giggling. During the pause, one of his pupils stargazes around and sees the gutted chronic dangling by his heel. She gasps and jumps back. The public relation turns and catches sight of the corpse and rushes to take one of those limp hands and give it a spin. The student shrinks forward for a cautious look, face in a trance.
"You see? You see? You see? You see?"
He squeals and rolls his eyes and spews stuff from his flask. He's laughing so hard. He's laughing till I think he'll explode. When he finally drowns the laughing, he starts back along the row of machines and goes into his lecture again. He stops suddenly and slaps his forehead. "Oh, scatterbrained me!" and comes running back to the hanging chronic to rip off another trophy and tie it to his girdle. Right and left, there are other things happening just as bad, crazy, horrible things, too goofy and outlandish to cry about and too much true to laugh about. But the fog is getting thick enough I don't have to watch. And somebody's tugging at my arm. I know already what will happen. Somebody will drag me out of the fog, and we'll be back on the ward. And there won't be a sign of what went on tonight. And if I was fool enough to try and tell anybody about it, they'd say, "Idiot, you just had a nightmare. Things as crazy as a big machine room down in the bowels of a dam where people get cut up by robot workers don't exist." But if they don't exist, how can a man see them? It's Mr. Turkle that pulls me out of the fog by the arm, shaking me and grinning. He says,
"You having a bad dream, Mr. Bromden?"
He's the aide, works the long, lonely shift from 11 to 7. an old Negro man with a big sleepy grin on the end of a long wobbly neck. He smells like he's had a little to drink.
Back to sleep now, Mr. Bromden.
Some nights he'll untie the sheet from across me if it's so tight I squirm around. He wouldn't do it if he thought the day crew knew it was him.